to today's segment of our Briefly Focused series, Understanding ADHD in Lawyers. I'm Belinda McCauley, Executive Director of the Beverly Hills Bar Association, and I'm so happy to be here today to introduce your speaker, Annie Little. Annie is a real estate lawyer turned ICF certified coach who specializes in supporting lawyers through their job searches, career transitions, and ascent to leadership positions within their organizations. Annie founded JD Nation in 2012 to pursue her vision of a world in which everyone has a fulfilling job, a humane workplace, and a life they're excited to live. Through executive and career coaching, Annie strives to create that world for lawyers by helping them find their ideal job, advocate for themselves at work, and enjoy a life of flexibility and freedom. Annie, we are so looking forward to learning from you today, and now the floor is yours.
So understanding ADHD in lawyers, just a quick bio. Belinda, you gave me such a lovely intro. Just a little more. I am a career and ADHD coach to hundreds of lawyers, but I'm more recently an ADHD coach because I was diagnosed with ADHD in 2021. And after that point, I realized that many of my clients had it, but they didn't share that with me until I shared my diagnosis. And I was like, what's going on? So before we go any further, let's just start with what is ADHD? Like, what does that stand for? And it stands for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which is a bit of a misnomer, but that's what it stands for. I wish we could name it something else, maybe someday. So here's what we are going to, where we're going to go today, what we're going to talk about. We are going to first dispel common misconceptions about ADHD, because that tends to lead to stigma, and that's where we are in the legal profession. And so the big thing is we want to make sure that we understand that ADHD is not a personal failing or a lack of willpower or some kind of flimsy excuse. Then we're going, in order to do that, what's really helpful is to understand how an ADHD brain operates differently from a neurotypical brain. Neurotypical meaning what norm, like, is more commonly happening in a brain that develops like everyone else's. And then third, we are going to learn some strategies for how to improve work performance and emotional well-being for lawyers who happen to have ADHD. So if you don't have ADHD or you don't really care, like, why are we talking about this? Why should all lawyers have an understanding of ADHD? And that is because if you're a lawyer or you work with lawyers, the statistical odds are that either you or someone you work with has ADHD. Because we know from a 2016 ABA mental health survey that 1 in 8 lawyers has ADHD. So 12.5% of lawyers in the profession have that. And for reference, that is 2.5 times the rate of ADHD in the general population, which is around 5%. And what we know is that that 1 in 8 figure, that 12.5%, is the floor. It's probably quite a bit higher. And that's because many lawyers with ADHD are unwilling to disclose it for fear of retaliation in some way or discrimination. And also, many don't know they have it. For example, if I had taken this survey, this ABA survey in 2016, I would have said, no, I do not have ADHD. I very much do. Another reason why it's important for everybody in the legal profession to understand how ADHD affects lawyers is that people with ADHD are at higher risk for certain mental health conditions, especially depression and anxiety, which we know already occur at high rates among lawyers. So on the flip side, also, if you or someone you know is experiencing anxiety or depression, it's just something to keep in mind that ADHD may also be a factor and something worth looking into. I was diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder when I was 26, and I'm telling you, I would have really liked to have gotten an ADHD diagnosis of some sort in those 15 years between when I got that first diagnosis. So those two are the most important reasons why it's important for all of us to understand. Now, as we go through, we are going to be operating in a framework of neurodiversity. And that's a term that we throw around a lot, but here's what it means for our purposes today. Neurodiversity as a concept views differences in the way people's brains process information, communicate, interact with the world, They view those different, neurodiversity views those differences as not only a positive phenomenon, but a necessary one that improves the overall human experience. So people who are neurodivergent don't need to be fixed. It's similar to the concept of biodiversity, where, the more diversity there is in an ecosystem, the healthier the ecosystem is. And these are just some of the conditions that may fall under this category of neurodiversity. So you see like ADHD, autism, dyspraxia, OCD, dyscalculia, but there are quite a few. So the three central tenets of neurodiversity that I'll be referring back to throughout are as follows. First, that variation is common. So although about 5% of the adult population has ADHD, that's an estimate, 15 to 20% of the population falls under that definition of neurodiverse. Number two, neurotypical does not mean better. Like I said before, neurotypical brains are closer to what is most common with the way most brains develop. And so about 80 to 85% of the human population is neurotypical. But more common does not equate to automatically better, more valuable, or more capable. And vice versa, like neurodivergence isn't, better in any at all either. And the third tenet, which is probably why we're having this presentation today, is that neurodiversity needs to be embraced and accommodated. In other words, awareness is not the end goal. It's good. It's good. It's a start, right? But to get to embracing, accepting neurodiversity, that means we need to have reasonable accommodations for different types of brains. And one way to kind of remember this is to think about the way the world is structured, because it is structured by and for people with neurotypical brains. So every day, people who do not fit into the neurotypical sort of rubric, so someone like me who has ADHD, I wake up every day and the world that I exist in was not made for me. And that's what accommodations are about. And then ultimately, we know that failure to accept and embrace neurodiversity leads to shame, stigma, and mental health struggles for those who are neurodivergent. And we already know that the legal profession has a lot of mental health struggles, shame, and stigma already. All right, so a huge contributor to stigma around ADHD is due to common misconceptions. So stigmatization leads to shame, which leads to isolation, which we know is one of the drivers of both anxiety and depression. And like I said a million times by now, right? Both of which are mental health epidemics in the legal profession. And I'm not putting this stuff up here to kind of call anyone on the carpet or anything like that. Because listen, until I was diagnosed a few years ago, I had all of these misconceptions because, I grew up in the United States in the 90s. And so there was this sort of horrible stereotype that people with ADHD were mostly hyperactive boys who got bad grades in school, and then they were forced to take medication that turned them into zombies. And really, the whole situation could have been avoided with better parenting. Okay, so there's just like so much stigma like leading to explode in there. No wonder nobody wanted to talk about it, right? But even beyond that, this kind of misunderstanding prevented people like me from recognizing that I might have ADHD and getting treatment sooner. And that's because like my background didn't look anything like this common 90s stereotype. And if you have ADHD and you know you do, you're probably like, yeah, that wasn't what I looked like, my background looked like either. So by improving our literacy around ADHD, it helps us to dispel misconceptions, which can then make it easier for us to embrace and accommodate ADHD in the workplace and hopefully just in general. So we're going to go through a few quick facts to dispel the most common misconceptions I come across. So the definition of ADHD, right? It stands for attention deficit. No. There is absolutely no deficit of attention in the ADHD brain. There instead is an abundance of attention that is not regulated. Okay? It's a deficit in the moderation. And this comic by Danny Donovan, who's an ADHD, I guess, I don't know about educator, whatever. She makes comics about ADHD. This is a really great one, and I will refer to this a few times throughout because the ADHD brain operates in extremes. It's like we bounce between overstimulation and understimulation. And in different contexts, that can mean different things. Like for motivation, either we can't get started on something, even if we really want to, or once we're doing something, we can't stop. We're just dialed in. It's good luck getting us to stop. Time, we view time as either now or not now. Like later is just not now. Like we're just, it's out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. Sleep, we either sleep too much, don't get enough sleep, talking too much, zoning out. This light switch analogy really applies to everything in the ADHD brain. As and you can think of a neurotypical brain as operating on a dimmer switch. So you can adjust it and and there's a middle ground and you can sense your body and your brain know, oh, I'm starting to get hungry. No. Either I'm not hungry or I'm starving. Like that's just where I notice. And you also know if you've ever played with a light switch to get it to stick in the middle, you might be able to get it to stick in the middle, but that doesn't make the light dimmer. It just makes it like flicker or just not work at all. Perfect analogy. The ADHD brain. Also, ADHD has historically been underdiagnosed because we are hearing a lot these days about how ADHD is being diagnosed so much and it's so overdiagnosed. I just read this article in the New York Times yesterday. It is not great. But we're hearing so much about this increase in diagnoses because primarily we are playing catch up with women and girls who ADHD, with us, ADHD looks very different. And we're also playing catch up with high achievers of both genders. At the same time, it is also true that historically boys have been overdiagnosed. Absolutely, it's a real problem. But both facts can be true at the same time, and one of those facts sucks. It's boys getting overdiagnosed. And the other one is really great for those of us who were overlooked as kids, especially, because not only is it helping us now, but for those of us who have kids, there's a 70 to 90% chance you pass it to your kids, we can get them help sooner. ADHD is not correlated with IQ in any way. Okay, so not all people with ADHD are high achievers, and vice versa. Anytime, like in this article from in the New York Times yesterday, they were saying, oh, all these people that took these kids that took Ritalin, like their behavioral issues were resolved, but it didn't improve their academics. Like, well, yeah. medication doesn't make you smarter. That's not what it does. What it does is it helps to regulate the brain's attention. And what can happen for somebody who might have behavioral issues, and then when they get treatment for ADHD, their academic or work performance improves, is that ADHD has a very negative impact on the brain's executive functioning. And we will talk about that. ADHD has a genetic basis, like I mentioned. If like someone like me, I have ADHD, that means I have a 70 to 90% chance of passing that on to one of my kids. I have one kid that has it, one kid that I don't think has it. So it's not something that like you can get by watching TV or bad parenting or something like that. That said, environmental stressors can exacerbate ADHD symptoms, and that's something we'll talk about specifically. And that's why accommodations in the workplace and elsewhere are so helpful and so necessary. Meds, have to bring this up, especially after that article I read yesterday. ADHD meds are not a silver bullet, okay? They provide temporary, imperfect support. I mean, the temporary meaning, even if you take an extended release formula, it's out of your system in less than a day. Another thing is that it's imperfect support. So meaning when you are taking ADHD medication, that doesn't make someone with ADHD neurotypical. All right, it helps us to regulate our attention and use it in a more directed way than normal or usual for us, I should say. Also, ADHD meds are not addictive when properly prescribed, meaning if you've got a prescription, you don't have to worry about getting addicted. Yeah, I kind of wish it were somewhat addictive because I forget to take my meds all the time, even though my meds are very helpful. I don't have any side effects. Like, ugh. So they're not addictive. If you take them normally, if you're not crushing them up and injecting them or snorting them, that's really where that comes in. But truly, stimulant medication for ADHD is highly effective for helping with executive functioning. And it's stimulant like caffeine. Okay. So they don't get people high, they just help people to regulate their attention better. And side note, some people with ADHD they find that when they ingest caffeine, it actually makes them tired rather than alert. So some people, that's how they figured out. Okay. So what can ADHD look like in lawyers? Because I've said, people have been overlooked so much. So here's what it can look like in the workplace. It can look like difficulty setting priorities, like knowing where to start first, missing deadlines, being disorganized, forgetting verbal instructions, missing details, poor time management. Really, these are the things that, like, I remember high school teachers saying, like, these are the simple skills you should have already learned by now. Well, okay, that's not true. These are referring to executive function skills, and these are challenging for everybody, okay, regardless of whether or not they have ADHD. But as you probably are gathering, it's much more debilitating for people with ADHD. But here's what this executive dysfunction, so problems with executive function, can look like in legal practice. Missed deadlines, low billables, often because of not turning in timesheets, chronic tardiness, emotional reactivity. Emotional regulation is an executive function. And overwhelm and burnout. So I love this meme from Transactional Goddess, because it's like there's no great so it feels like there are no great options if you have ADHD for some executive functions. It's like enter my time daily, living nightmare. Wait until the last possible moment to enter all my time for the week, also a living nightmare. What are my options? So there are so many of us who have practiced law with untreated ADHD. So how does that happen, right? Because I was successful. Most people are successful that I work with who happen to have ADHD. And it's not that there's high functioning ADHD. What's actually going on is that high achievers in particular are really good at hijacking the body's stress response. And so we are using like negative self-talk, stress, other things to get the cortisol and adrenaline flowing. And that can sort of mimic the effects of dopamine, but that system degrades over time. Ask me how I know. So this is a very common graphic you may see with ADHD, the iceberg. It's like what people think ADHD is. So at the top, it's like trouble focusing and fidgeting, maybe, sure. But what it really is underneath the surface, you can see it's so much. I think that there's more than like 200 symptoms of ADHD. I don't know. It's a lot. And everybody experiences them differently. But if you look under there, a lot of what's underneath refers to executive function or executive dysfunction in the case of ADHD. So, like having a poor sense of time, difficulty switching tasks or sticking to one task, problems following conversations, choice paralysis, analysis paralysis, losing things, problems focusing on things, even if you want to focus. So you can look at that in more detail if you want later. But I don't like to dwell on it because there are strengths that are inherent to ADHD that are really valuable in legal practice. So I like to focus more on the ADHD strengths iceberg. And this is different from looking at like DISC strengths or strengths finders. And we're also not reframing ADHD symptoms as like, oh, this is a negative symptom, we're going to reframe it in a positive. No, these are actually things that are you can leverage. To be successful. And many of my ADHD clients who are lawyers, that's what they have done. So, what people think ADHDers are good at, talking fast, check. Creativity, sure. But what we're really good at, I love the first one. It's like literally anything they find interesting. Okay. And when that happens, you might have heard of the term hyperfocus before. So, think about the light switch, like one end of focusing is like, the complete inability to focus, and then the other extreme is focusing to the detriment of everything else, like ignoring your bodily needs, not hearing alarms, like really, really focused. But people, the ADHD brain is great at solving problems, really great at making connections, recognizing patterns, We can ADHD brain can process complex concepts really efficiently and effectively when the person is interested in it. But one thing that I find, in addition to people with ADHD being highly empathetic and more optimistic, especially than most lawyers, their counterparts, lawyers, people with ADHD in general have a strong sense of injustice or a strong sense of justice, or to look at it from the other way, an intolerance to perceived unfairness. And that is what is brings a lot of people with ADHD into the legal profession. Now, because of the stigma around ADHD, especially the misconception that it has something to do with intelligence and that smart people cannot have ADHD, I just like to put this list here that you can refer to later of famous people with ADHD, but note the glaring absence of anyone from the legal field. Stigma. Someday maybe we'll have a judge tell us that they have ADHD, because statistically a lot of them do. But I love this. There's like this interview with Stephen Hawking, who happened, he had ADHD. And somebody asked him, you know, how have you been so successful despite having ADHD? And he's like, are you kidding me? It's because of my ADHD. He's like, I just followed my interests and I investigated things that other people thought weren't important, but I found them interesting, so I pursued them anyway. And it led to all these fascinating discoveries. So sometimes you will even hear this phrasing, twice the exception or twice exceptional. And so that can refer to like people who have ADHD and are also considered gifted. I don't really like the gifted designation, but I'll say like high achievers. So you're actually twice exceptional. You're twice the exception to what the most neurotypical type brain would be. Oh, before we, so Stephen Hawking, but we'll just, a few others we can name. Bill Gates has ADHD, Robert Branson does, Simone Biles, Michael Jordan, Shaq, Emma Watson, Ryan Reynolds, Zooey Deschanel. And then there are some people in there that are widely believed to have had ADHD, but they had never got a formal diagnosis, people like Einstein or Mozart. So I mentioned this a little bit when we were talking about, when I talked about the strong sense of justice that people with ADHD tend to have. So this can give us some insight into why there are so many more people with ADHD in the legal profession than in the general population. So you think about like, well, how can I make a difference in the justice system or just unfairness? Law sounds like a good option, right? And we will get into some more specifics, but it's also because law is a challenging discipline. There's a lot of novelty that comes into it, and there are lots of urgent situations or crisis type situations where the ADHD brain tends to thrive. The ADHD brain tends to work well under time pressure and almost exclusively under time pressure. So if you've only been able to study by cramming, that's the only way you can do it, you might have ADHD. Okay, here are some common ADHD lawyer strengths that I encounter with my ADHD lawyer clients. P.S. Most of my ADHD clients are partners, equity partners. So that's another sort of misconception that this only impacts associates. No, you can be very successful. So as we're going through and talking about this kind of stuff, I just want to make sure that I'm clear that not every person with ADHD has all of these same strengths. And it's also possible for neurotypical people to have these strengths, but these are very, very common in the ADHD lawyers I work with. So working well under pressure, learning complex topics quickly, and being able to communicate them too. And the last two kind of go together with advanced pattern recognition and creative problem solving. So that contributes to being like a strategic, big picture thinker. With ADHD, there are always caveats, always, always. So here's what to remember as we go through this. ADHD can be paradoxical and idiosyncratic. No two people with ADHD are the same. My daughter and I have the exact same ADHD diagnosis, combined type. So we have both the hyperactivity and the inattentiveness in equal amounts. Our symptoms and their severity are completely different. Also, what works one day for someone with ADHD in terms of supports and accommodations might not work the next day. And it's not the fault of that person. Okay. There's always like the flip side to a coin when it comes to ADHD. So let's say You've got somebody with ADHD and they know that they work well under pressure. It's like, oh, I work really well under pressure, like a tight deadline, I can make it happen. So we know, oh, how can we work with that? Let's give them shorter deadlines because a longer deadline is going to fall into that person's concept of time, which is either now or not now. So for example, like a 2 month project, a 2 month deadline is not going to work for somebody with ADHD. It's going to fall off their radar. But if we can chunk it up into shorter deadlines, there's always a deadline to be working toward in that window of now. And that window of now varies for each person and the context, of course. Caveat, unrealistically short deadlines can cause anxiety and overwhelm. Okay. So yes, we work well under pressure, but not too much. That will completely disable us. All right, so let's say you've got somebody with ADHD who is a quick learner of complex concepts and then can communicate them effectively to others. What's key to someone with ADHD is that these projects, these complex concepts, complex concepts need to be interesting to them in some way. And that's really tricky because that's super, super individualized. But it's really, really important. And this goes down to the ADHD light switch trait being, if somebody is interested, you're either bored or engaged. And when someone with ADHD is bored, it is like really, really hard to start something or stick to something. So these are some, oh, I forgot to get to the caveat. This is always a fun one. It's easy to mistake interest and novelty. I refer to novelty as the new interest, like orange is the new black, novelty is the new interest. So novelty works as well. So if it's a complex concept that is new and exciting to someone with ADHD, that will work. But that doesn't mean they're going to go on to become like the subject matter expert on it necessarily, or that they should change jobs or practice groups to do it. You want to let it simmer a little while because it might just be novelty, and novelty wears off. A genuine interest does not. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's just I try to advise caution with my clients. I'm like, let's see if it's a true interest or there might be some novelty driving this as well. And let's say you've got someone with ADHD who is a strategic problem solver, a big picture type person, needs the big picture context. And this can be really tricky in legal practice, especially in a law firm setting, as everybody knows, when you come in as an associate, you're getting these little pieces of projects, right? And for me, I was a transactional lawyer, so I'd be drafting loan documents or leases or negotiating things. And it was so hard for me to know. I was like, I gotta know what the whole deal is. I know I can't be in on all the conversations because of billing, but you gotta give me the whole forest and then I can focus on the trees. Because if you give somebody with ADHD the greater context, you're empowering them to make connections and recognize patterns and to do that independently. Whereas if you give them just the bare minimum, they're going to have to come back and ask questions to be like, so is this what we're talking about? Or is it relevant to that? Is it, what about this? So I felt awful like having to ask all these questions and then I would procrastinate. It was a whole thing. So this is the light switch trait of ADHD here is refers to structure. And we oscillate between freedom and it feeling like a prison. But we need some structure in there. Because if we have too much freedom, we're gonna just think everything is important because we are driven by what is interesting to us, not by what is a priority. We can learn that, but initially we need help with being told, okay, here's the forest, but here's where we start. Here's what we're looking for. And this is the stuff that you do not need to address. All right. So those are the strengths. And I feel like it's total rapid fire, but you have these slides. You can go back at any time. But I've been mentioning executive functioning quite a bit, and it's a word that we all throw around and we think we know what it means. So let's just level set on that before we talk about the interaction of ADHD and executive function. Executive function is the cognitive process that enables us to organize our thoughts and activities, to prioritize tasks, manage time efficiently, make decisions, make choices, which is actually slightly different, and to regulate emotions. So this enables us to plan, focus our attention, remember instructions, manage multiple tasks, not necessarily multitasking, but manage multiple things simultaneously. So very important. It's also very high level and very energy intensive. So my favorite, yes, I have favorites, but my favorite ADHD researcher is Dr. Russell Barkley. He is now retired and his YouTube channel is phenomenal. He updates it regularly. He's great. And he has referred to ADHD at times as an executive function deficit disorder. I really like that framing because it recognizes that everyone suffers from executive function deficits to some degree, depending on circumstances. However, this does not mean that everyone's a little ADHD. And so that's why people with ADHD get really kind of bent out of shape if some people say that, because it's very different. Because yes, we can all relate to each other with our bouts of executive dysfunction, but people with ADHD, we suffer from chronic debilitating executive dysfunction. Okay, and each of us has our own worst, executive functions. And the takeaway, though, that I love about thinking about it in this way is that everyone can benefit from lowering the demands on our brain's executive function, right? Like, this isn't something that's only for ADHD people. It's necessary for people with ADHD, but it benefits everyone. These are like the productivity hacks you read about. So it's another common misconception that accommodations are unfair advantages or simply unnecessary. But really, they just allow lawyers to do their jobs, which they're already capable of doing, with less struggle, less anxiety, less stress. Okay. And that makes them more efficient or productive, if we're going to use those terms. So, although we can develop executive function skills in people with ADHD, we go about it in a very different way than if somebody were neurotypical. And that is why it's important to understand and learn about ADHD-informed approaches so that we can give people with ADHD the skills and the supports to get those executive function where they don't have to struggle. They don't have to feel like they're working 10 times as hard as their neurotypical counterparts. So yes, we're going to talk a little bit about the neuroscience of executive dysfunction. And this is, I've gotten feedback, very positive feedback when I've talked about this, that people will say understanding the science makes it even easier to remove like the idea that someone might be lazy or just not trying hard enough when they understand, oh, it's about dopamine in the brain and we cannot control dopamine any more than we can control like our insulin levels, you know? So my guy, Dr. Russell Barkley, he breaks this down really nicely. He says ADHD is not a disorder of not knowing. We know what to do. The ADHD brain's like, yes, we know what to do. It's a disorder of not doing or not executing on what we know needs to be done. So ADHD brains know what to do. It's executing on that knowledge that's problematic, to say the least. It's frustrating for everybody involved, but to be in the body and be like, I know I need to do this. I want to do this. Why can I physically not do it? And it's because doing something requires dopamine. Executing on that knowledge requires that neurotransmitter. A couple others, but this is the main one. And what's important to remember about dopamine, I don't like the stuff about rewards and happiness and all that kind of stuff. I like to think of it as the motivation neurotransmitter. It's the motivation hormone. It's what gets you to follow through on what you know needs to be done. And a neurotransmitter, it's just a fancy name for a hormone in the brain. And it just carries, so dopamine carries encoded messages from one part of the brain to the other. In particular, we'll use Dr. Barkley's characteristics of it, the knowing brain and the doing brain. Very simple. So this is a gift that I made. And I was so excited when I showed my kids. And I said, you know, I like to think of dopamine as like carrier pigeons. And they're carrying messages from the knowing part of the brain to the doing part of the brain. And in a neurotypical brain, this is what it looks like. You know, it's like the knowing brain's like, yo, dopamine, we got some boring emails we got to write right now. And so the carrier pigeons show up, they grab the encoded message, and they go down the neural pathways to the doing part of the brain. They're like, here you go, doing brain. Doing brain opens the messages and follows the instructions and executes. Amazing. So I'm like, this is how I imagine it looks like in a neurotypical brain because I don't have one. And my kids were like, those aren't carrier pigeons, those are doves. I said, like I said, this is how I envision it working because this is what my carrier pigeons feel like. So in the ADHD brain, the carrier pigeons, aka the dopamine, often goes rogue. It's MIA. It may not come when the knowing brain says, yo, we've got these boring emails we got to write right now. Maybe the carrier pigeons don't show up. Maybe they do, but then they drop the message before they get to the doing part of the brain, or they take the wrong neural pathway, or they fall asleep, or they eat it. Like, there are so many things that can go awry in the dopamine delivery system that it's a part of why ADHD is so complicated and so hard to understand sometimes. And this is also why it's important for us to remember that there's the carrier pigeons that we don't have control over, the dopamine, because it's not being lazy. And that's something that I used to tell myself to hijack my stress response. Like, why are you so lazy? Like, you could do this before. Why are you not doing it now? But the thing is, when you're lazy, when you're being lazy, you're enjoying lazing around and not doing things. So I say, yeah, sure, it's laziness, but make it miserable because it's like, I know it needs to be done, but I can't start. I can't, for whatever reason, I can't start. And then I feel stuck and overwhelmed. And then I'm like, oh, I don't want to do it, but then I need to do it. And then, ooh, that urgency kicks in. I've got this deadline. I've got a time crunch. I thrive in a time crunch. Here we go. And I'm like, man, why couldn't I have done that sooner? And the cycle repeats. All right. So we know that that dopamine is responsible for most of what's happening between the knowing and the doing. So how do we get the carrier pigeons? Like, can we do anything about it? And yes, the research shows us that we can. There are things we can do. So first we'll start with what it's like in the neurotypical brain, the one with the doves that follow things pretty seamlessly. So the doves, the neurotypical brain, that the dopamine system there responds to importance-based triggers. The neurotypical nervous system is an importance-based nervous system. So there's not going to be anything revelatory here. This is how our society is structured. So this refers to things that are like, if there's something that's important to you, you will do it. If it's important to others who are important to you, like your boss or your significant other or whatever, if it's important to someone else like that, you will do it. If there's an anticipated reward, you'll do it. And if you can avoid a negative consequence by doing something, you'll do it, right? This is how incentives are structured in our society for the most part. And so in a neurotypical brain, boom, yeah, makes sense. ADHD brain doesn't work that way. And so we're like, what is wrong? What is wrong with us? There's nothing wrong with the ADHD brain. It is just different. It is based on importance-based dopamine triggers. So people with ADHD, we have an interest-based nervous system rather than an importance-based one. This is just different, not better, not worse. Okay. So the four main dopamine triggers, summoners, however you want to think about it, are things that are interesting, which depends on the person, things that are challenging or fun, gamifying things can work, things that are novel, new, and of course, things that are urgent. So these are the four interest-based triggers that we are going to be sort of pulling it over the next few many slides, let's say. But we'll take a quick timeout because this is often where my neurotypical people are thinking or asking, like, well, yes, guess what? I also prefer to do things that are interesting. But if it's important, even if it's boring and awful, I just get it done because it's important. It needs to be done. And yes, if you're neurotypical, you can do that. And interest-based triggers are nice to have. You can make that unsavory task that you have to do that's important that you don't want to, you can make it a little more palatable by also injecting some of these interest-based triggers. You will respond to those as well. It's again like those productivity hacks or life hacks you might read about. But what's important to know is that for ADHD brains, interest-based triggers are necessary. Without them, there's no dopamine that's going between to carry those messages between the knowing and the doing parts of the brain. And if there's no dopamine, there's no doing, right? So we keep that in mind as we're coming up with accommodations or ways to support our ADHD lawyers in the workplace. So that's what we're going to talk about here is like, how can we minimize the executive dysfunction for people with ADHD by using that interest-based nervous system, by leveraging what research has shown us about that? Because remember, we're not here to fix people with ADHD. Neurodiversity views these differences as good. They don't need to be fixed or eliminated, but we need to help help people with ADHD to adapt to a world that wasn't made for them. So here are the three most common executive dysfunction issues I see with my clients, and that, of course, I experience as well. But you know, this is what we would tend to call them: procrastination, disorganization, forgetfulness. But we are also going to neutralize those because they tend to have a like a you know negative connotation. But it's not that we're reframing it necessarily, but we are going to recognize, okay, this is what it is, and then what is going on in the ADHD brain so that we can then that will help to guide us towards possible solutions, so to speak, or accommodations. I feel like I'm saying the word accommodation too much. Okay, so let's say I'm procrastinating, you know, but it doesn't really, I mean, like, I really want to do this thing, but I can't. I'm just going to put it off because it feels yuck. Okay, and it's not due immediately. So what we can do. Yes, procrastination, which sounds like you have no willpower, you can't start. What this is an issue with task initiation, starting something. That's an executive function. Okay. And so there can be any number of things that are going on there. You just heard me rattling them off, like, oh, it's not urgent, or I don't feel like it, or so it takes a little experimentation to figure out what's going on. But we know these are some things you can try. Is somebody procrastinating because it's the project is a long-term one and the deadline is too far off? Great. Chunk it down into some smaller deadlines. Great. Is there a way to make it more challenging? Make it like a game in some way? I did that with unknowingly, I did that with my time entries. Is there a way to inject novelty into the situation? Like for me, that can be as simple as like sitting on this couch behind me instead of sitting in this chair at the desk. I mean, sometimes the brain is very simple. A really effective and sort of funny one is called body doubling or mirroring. And many people haven't heard of this, but really what it is, it's like sitting with somebody. Like if you, so I have ADHD and I just sit with somebody, doesn't matter if they have ADHD or not. And we sit in the same place while we work or do tasks. And for some reason, it really helps people with ADHD to like focus their attention and get something done. We're not exactly sure why. It seems to be, it might be a form of co-regulation. It eases like anxiety. It might be that balance between like freedom for structure, right? It's that balance between freedom and prison. You know, we don't have like a taskmaster telling us like, you got to do this, but also we have somebody there next to us. And maybe it's like a challenge or a game where it's like, well, I can be just as productive as they can. We don't know. But what this means is if you have ADHD, this is many people report this is like the most effective intervention that they use. So you can get a co-working buddy or several in the office. And when you're struggling, go meet in a conference room or go re meet somewhere else or in your office. And if you aren't in an office, like if you work virtually or if it's just not an option for some other re whatever reason, FocusMate is a great virtual co-working platform. I have used it. And so you hop on, both people keep their screens on. You just type in, here's what I'm going to be working on for the next however many minutes your session is scheduled for. And they say the same thing. And then you're like, cool. And then you go do it. And you could, as long as you can like stay in the frame, you can do more than just like work. So some people like hang up, you know, frames. It's like, I'm going to be hanging up these frames and you'll be able to see me doing it. It's amazing. So this is a little, this is one of my favorite ones that I like to bring up because people are like, whoa, no way. Okay, so let's say you've got someone with ADHD who seems to be disorganized or frazzled, like organization is tough. This can be the executive dysfunction here can be around prioritization and or ordination. And ordination refers to doing things in a particular order, whereas prioritization is understanding which thing is most important and therefore should be considered or considered first. But when you have an interest-based nervous system, anything that's interesting is important. It's the same thing. We don't view it that way. So when it comes to projects, if this is an executive function that's hard for you, it's okay to ask a supervisor to say, hey, help me prioritize. What's most, what are your priorities on this? I used to ask that all the time. I didn't realize what I was doing, but I was like, here's what else I've got going on. What's a priority for you? And then if it's something that's going to be like recurring, these type of projects or like if for me, like doing commercial lease amendments, it would be helpful to put together a cheat sheet so I could know this is the high priority things to start with first, then this, and even these are the high priority clients that need to be responded to in a certain way within a certain time frame, so that you're not always having to ask. That's one way of learning, all right, is really having cheat sheets. A big one that I love to do for this for myself, and many of my clients find this helpful as well, is at the end of the day, do a brain dump so that you're like, this is where I left off with things, and I know at this point what I need to work on first thing. Like it's easier to remember like what's really hot, like what are people wanting from me at the end of the day, as opposed to coming in the next morning or at the end of a weekend and being like, oh, so what am I supposed to do first? 'Cause I don't want to do that. Yeah, Dwight, I will have seven first priorities. No, that's not how that works. And here's another visualization. This is Danny Donovan again. And so non-ADHD, it's like, that's not important. This is important. This is all relevant to the task I'm completing. If you've got an interest-based nervous system, it's like, it's interesting, so it's important. And then some things that are important but are uninteresting won't get done too. All right. What if you've got someone who you're like, God, they're so forgetful or they're so flaky or something? What's happening there is likely related to working memory deficits. All right. And so, what you're going to want to do in these situations is to brainstorm, come up with some accommodations that help people to make fewer mistakes and require less need for clarification and follow-up. I do have some auditory processing issues related to my ADHD. So, one thing I can sit there and I could take notes. Like a partner would be telling me what to do and I could take notes, but like I might not get it right or whatever. But I knew that I had trouble remembering details like that. So I tried to get it down, but it was so hard. But what I could have said is, hey, boss, good talk. Could you just pop in an email exactly what you want me to do? And they could say yes or no. Fair point. Like if my assistant were to ask me to put instructions in writing, I'd be like, no, I cannot do that. That's not going to work. I will never get that to you. I could provide an alternative. I could say, you're welcome to record our conversations about this and or send me an email afterward and say, hey, this is what I got from our meeting. This is what I'm going to be working on. Did I miss anything? Or can you clarify anything? And I'll say, yes, I could look at that email and get back to you right away. And that's just understanding which executive functions give me the most trouble as opposed to the ones that don't. And this is another one that we can benefit from having, like if it's something that's going to be recurring, having flow charts and timelines and things like that so that we're not having to constantly go back over and over again. It's unavoidable in a lot of situations, but that's one way to limit, so to speak, the sort of follow-up you need. And this is a great visualization of what the limits on working memory look like for somebody with ADHD. Listen, working memory, so there's three types of memory. There's short-term memory, long-term memory, and working memory. So short-term and long-term are like encoded, right? I'm saying right, like we're all cognitive psychologists. That was one of my majors. Okay. But working memory, I like to think about it as like the kitchen island. Right? Like when you're making something, working memory is where you have all of this information available that you're going to be using relatively soon. So there's a lot of stuff out and it's there to be accessible, right? So the bigger the kitchen island, the more stuff you can keep on it. Well, lucky for those of us with ADHD, our working memory table is like a drink table, like that little one behind me. It's just smaller. So you can see, like on the neurotypical working memory table, it's imperfect as well. There's stuff that falls off to the side. Nobody's working memory is perfect. We all will walk into a room and be like, why am I here? But does it happen to you 4 times a day? It does to me. And it always has. So that visualization is really helpful when it's like, ah, I can't believe I forgot that again. And I'm like, you know what? It's just the way it is. Like my third grader's like, Mom, your working memory table is so small. I'm like, that's right, bud. It is. So I ran through some examples of, hey, you got somebody who's got this executive dysfunction happening. Here are some ideas. Here are some more resources. Job Accommodation Network, askjan.org. It's actual examples of real life accommodations people have put into action. Also ideas for other ones. Last I checked, both of these guidance documents on the Americans with Disability Act are still up on the government website. So there's an EEOC one. It's so specific. Reasonable accommodations for lawyers with disabilities. So there's no real nice clean URL for that. So just Google EEOC and then type in that verbatim. And same for the Department of Labor. Accommodations for employees with mental health conditions, which includes things like anxiety and stuff like that. And what's really cool is as you go through these guidance documents, they're not using diagnostic terms. So they're not saying this person has ADHD and this is what they need. No, they just describe it and I'll be like, oh, that sounds like somebody with ADHD. But it's like there is no need to disclose your diagnosis or even have a diagnosis. If you need something to do your job better, you can ask. And those are some great places to get some ideas. All right. And a lot of what you are going to see when you go to those websites are solutions that are going to help to manage external stressors, things in the environment. Remember we talked when I mentioned that ADHD is genetic. And that it's not caused by the environment, but it can be worsened by the environment. And this is what we're talking about here. And what can happen, here's when you know an external stressor is probably being, it's super disruptive because you will know, ah, I'm totally leveraging my ADHD magic, whatever my strengths are. I've got interest-based triggers to overlay on top of the important stuff that people are telling me I need to do. And it's been working, but today it's not. Why am I not able to do the thing today? There's something that's sabotaging your executive function. For me, working at home, it's usually a leaf blower outside. So you can think of them as like external focus breakers, things that are not like happening necessarily inside your brain that you can control. That said, these are things that you can take note of, anticipate, so that you can mitigate them as they may arise. But I group these into three categories of fatigue, distraction, and overwhelm. And the visual that's really helpful here is to think of like a neurotypical brain. Remember, neurotypical brains have an ability to regulate attention and other sort of functions in it, whereas the ADHD brain, that's the feature of it, is it is an inability to self-regulate, an inability to moderate pretty much everything. So neurotypical brains have this kind of filter to help filter out the things that aren't important or aren't helpful. ADHD brains don't have that. So literally hypersensitive, very sensitive. And so it's important for you to understand which of these sort of external stressors are real focus breakers for you. So for me, I've got all kinds of different like earplugs and headphones and things that can block out sound entirely, other things that allow me to participate in conversations, but it's just filtering out the other stuff. But so when it comes to fatigue, lack of sleep, and I know sometimes we can't control that, but figuring out how much sleep you need and working on that is really important, especially because ADHD brains need more sleep. We work harder. Our brains work faster and harder and need more recovery time. Illness, again, you can't necessarily control for that, but it explains a like why your focus might not be working that day. Hunger also. ADHD brain, it's either I'm not hungry or I'm starving. So having a high protein snack available, it's kind of healthy, like nuts are a good quick one. Distraction. These are the sort of sensory things, like lighting. For me, it's noises, like physical irritations. But so people, might want to request having different types of lighting in your office, like if the overhead lighting is too severe, or having some sort of blocker on your monitor if it's too bright, or being able to put it in dark mode if that's whatever. And overwhelm. This one's tough too, but it's very, very important. Emotions, because emotional regulation is an executive function too. So if you're going through a tough time, like grieving the death of somebody, yeah, your systems aren't going to work as well. Hormones. So if you're undergoing some sort of treatment that's messing with your hormones, like chemotherapy, or you're pregnant, or you're going through perimenopause or menopause, be forewarned. Estrogen and dopamine are linked. So, it's tough. And also just extreme stress and going through burnout. That's going to break your focus. It's going to make it much, much harder for your brain to filter out what it needs to and regulate that attention. So this is just what I was talking about. Like if, let's say, sound is the external stressor, that's the worst. Like mine rises to the level of misophonia. So I've got noise canceling headphones. I've got the loop reducing, sound reducing earplugs so that I can participate in conversations. Some people will use a sound machine or an ambient noise machine. Putting on music sometimes can hold our floating attention, and distract us from something that's a more irritating sound. But finding a place that where you can get if like absolute quiet is what you're looking for, making sure that you have access to a place like that where you'll be free from interruptions can be really helpful at work. And also, I always like to say, unapologetically and aggressively using the do not disturb function on your email, texts, and that sort of thing. And it requires conversation with your supervisors. But if you're in a position of managing people, work on ways to make do not disturb happen when it needs to. And as we're coming to the end, I promise we're almost there. Here are some, like the executive function accommodations that we've talked about so far. They're necessary, right, for people with ADHD, but they're beneficial for everyone, all lawyers. Like there should be no hesitation for anybody to be asking for things that can help them to do their best work. Because I mentioned this briefly before, but executive functions are very energy intensive. I call them cognitively expensive tasks. Like it just takes more energy for both neurotypical and ADHD brains. So everybody can benefit from lowering the demand on this. And the way that you can do this and to get the any sort of support or accommodation that might help you in this way is to first understand how you work best. So for me, I could say something like, I've actually said this to people when they've asked me to do CLEs like this. I'll say, ooh, okay, so it's a few months down the road. Listen, I work really well with shorter deadlines. With longer deadlines, I kind of lose track. So what are some things, what would you prefer to have first? And when would you love to have it by? Nowhere in there did I say, I have ADHD, I need shorter timelines for my deadlines. You do not have to do that in order to advocate for yourself. Just explaining like, ooh, I've just learned about myself that I'm so much better off when this is a situation. So recognizing those circumstances, identifying what might be helpful to you so that you can then ask, go advocate for yourself. If you are in a position of leadership, or management or what anything like that, encourage people to talk about these sorts of things just by saying, hey, if there's something you need in order to do your job better, don't hesitate to ask. Like, we'll figure something out. Even if, and that doesn't mean that if somebody comes to you and says, hey, I think I could, this would help me to do my job better. You don't have to say, okay, if it's not reasonable. That's where the term reasonable accommodation comes in. It needs to be reasonable on both ends. And you want to focus on the strength, right? Rather than saying, which just is mean, instead of saying like, oh my gosh, I'm so bad with deadlines, just saying like, shorter deadlines are better for me, because that's focusing on my strength of working well on a tight deadline. I just know that. I just know that I work better that way. Also, lowering demand on executive functions can, it asks, it requires, I guess I should say, that you manage your external stressors. So if you know that you might be, for me, if I'm going to be in an environment where somebody's going to be crunching loud foods in a quiet place, I gotta have my earplugs. Gotta have it. And the most important thing here is to normalize recalibration. And that is because systems for people with ADHD work until they don't. Okay. And that is normal and expected and not the fault of the person who has an ADHD brain. Sometimes systems work long term, and that is a pleasant surprise. But it's important to note that that would be an outlier. Okay. That's not the expectation. The expectation is that systems will degrade over time by no fault of the ADHD individual. Instead, we want to build this skill of identifying when a system has stopped working for us and to develop alongside that skill resilience so that when a system falls apart, like this graphic shows, like life happens, brains happen, the system falls apart. Instead of being like, oh my God, I failed again. I haven't stuck to my system again. I'm a bad person. I have no willpower. Instead, it's like, oh, the system hasn't been working. Why? Because sometimes my clients will say, oh, I've tried that before. It doesn't work. I'm like, I believe you that it didn't work. Can we talk about maybe why it stopped working? Because sometimes it was something completely out of their control and it was a perfectly good system that just needed to be restarted. It didn't need to be completely overhauled. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes it's just stopped working anymore. Perhaps novelty has worn off, right? But this is what's important. Systems aren't going to work forever. It's a gift to be able to recognize when something has stopped working for you and be okay with figuring out why it stopped working and figuring out a new system for yourself. And this is the last thing before I'll summarize our takeaways. This is a very complicated, right? And there was a lot in here. And the image of the light switch, right? Overstimulation, understimulation. That is what the ADHD brain is bouncing between at all times. So that optimal middle ground, that little narrow hill that you see there. The neurotypical zone of optimal stimulation is much larger. ADHD brains, it's so fleeting. So there's you've got that narrow zone, and then we know that summoning and directing dopamine is very complicated. Those derpy carrier pigeons, OMG, so much can go wrong. So much can go right, but there's a lot of stuff that can happen in the meantime. So be kind to yourself, be kind to those around you. Everyone's doing their best. And when ADHD is a factor, it's just so much more complicated. So here are the three takeaways that I'm hoping you have gotten today. The first is that ADHD lawyers are wired for success and have valuable strengths that can be leveraged. And when doing that, it leads to even greater success and well-being. The next takeaway, interest-based interventions at work are necessary to reduce ADHD executive dysfunction. But it works for everyone, right? They're helpful for neurotypical people too, but they are necessary for the ADHD brain. And the third takeaway is that providing reasonable accommodations in the workplace improves work performance and it fosters emotional well-being for ADHD lawyers because it says, hey, we as a workplace, we accept you as you are. We embrace your brain, however it may function. And that is what helps the shame to fall away. And that's what also helps the stigma to fade away because you accept and embrace everyone because you want everyone to be successful in the workplace. And then this is just a list of resources, a few of the things that I've drawn on, things that have been helpful to my clients that you are welcome to refer back to. And if anybody has any questions, I have not been looking at the chat or the Q&A. Belinda, I don't know if there's anything you've noticed or if there are any questions that people may want.
All right, so we do actually have a couple questions. One is from Judith asking, have you had the chance to read the extensive research article published on by the New York Times on ADHD?
Yes, I read that. I commented on that quite a bit. Was there a specific question in there?
Yes, I was wondering about your response to the researchers who say that it is not a black and white diagnosis, rather existing on a continuum. The author also interviewed many scientists who are experts on saying that the studies are showing that medication loses its effect after 2 to 3 years.
Yep. Okay, so this is very complicated stuff to remember. But first of all, remember how I cited Dr. Russell Barkley many times? He's my favorite. He's like the preeminent researcher. They mentioned him. They did not interview him. They did not talk to him. Okay. That was a glaring omission. That was a, I'm just saying, like, that article was so poorly researched. It's not a black and white diagnosis in the sense of like, you will have these symptoms or not those symptoms or whatever. Or like, remember how I said my daughter and I both have a combined ADHD diagnosis. My most problematic symptom, task initiation, that's not hers. Hers is emotional regulation. I do not have problems with emotional regulation. Okay, so in that sense, it's not black and white, and that these are the symptoms that you will always get. Also, they didn't even mention, they said that the number one diagnostic criteria is the DSM. I'm like, it's actually the Vanderbilt assessment, which is kind of based on the DSM. And there's a reason why high achievers fall through the Vanderbilt assessment. And it's because, unless you have a super observant teacher, there are no issues with academic performance for high achievers. And in terms of the medication stops working, in the absence of hormones, which have a dramatic effect. So, like with my daughter, as she ages, we address the hormonal changes because, yes, some of her meds did stop at one point, but that happens. But for those who it stopped working entirely, they were only talking about men in this. They didn't bring up women or girls at all. So I would say for the men where it wasn't working, or those poor men and boys where they were like citing these horrible side effects, like, oh, I didn't feel like my fun self. Either they don't have ADHD, that's why the meds stopped working, or they need a different medication. There is so, it's not just Ritalin and Adderall anymore. There are so many, and that's just in the stimulant world. There are non-stimulants, there are supplements, there's so many other things. And so when I first started getting medication for myself, they started me on Ritalin. And those are the two main classes of drugs. You've got Ritalin, which is methylphenidate class, and then you've got Adderall, which is the methamphetamine class. And you tend to be either into one or the other. I started with Ritalin, and I was like, oh my God, is this what focus is like? I mean, it feels like my heart is gonna like, I have like a hummingbird heart and I might explode, but it's cool. It's cool. I'll take it. I'll deal with it. And they're like, no, you don't need to deal with tachycardia to like have some focus here. They're like, there are many other drugs we can try. You're probably just better off in the other class, which I am. So those were the things that I saw. If the medication stopped working and nothing ever did, maybe they were overdiagnosed, as so many boys are, or they if the side effects were untenable and that's why they didn't want to take their meds, it's because they needed a different med class or something different entirely. And that also goes to like the misunderstanding of what medication is designed to do. It's not designed to make people neurotypical. They never will. It's designed to help minimize executive dysfunction primarily and increase that dopamine delivery system so that we can get more messages from the knowing part of the brain to the doing part of the brain. It's not about making somebody an academic superstar. If you're not already inclined for academics, medication's not going to do it for you either. Have so many feelings, but I'll stop there.
I actually have another one here as well. Judith asks again, I'd love to hear about the gamification of billing. Do you have
I
any?
know, wouldn't we all? So I will tell you what I did. It's not going to be super helpful. Billing is the most complicated issue that we ADHD coaches deal with. Like when I talk to my trainers and my fellow, like my peers, we're like, what have you found works? Because it needs to be so tailored to the individual because billing is such a gross thing from a psychological perspective. I just had like an epiphany with one of my clients recently, and it's like so magical, but it took us a year. Took us a year to get there. For me, I gamified it in the sense that I was like, okay, if I keep track of my time as I go through the day, I can leave work as soon. Like I had a job where I represented banks in my first job. And so it wasn't about FaceTime. It was just like I worked until the banks were closed, basically, and then I could go home. So I was like, if I keep track, first of all, I don't have to go back and review this boring stuff and try to call things up. And I don't have, and my bills are ready to go. And blah, blah, blah. And there were some macros and shortcuts in our system, but I always had it up. And I knew which stuff I was working on, had a desktop blotter. I still do. I still have like these big calendars. So I just had it in front of me. So on that day, I would write down my start time and the matter I was working on, whatever abbreviation I had. And my job, I had tons of interruptions. And so as soon as someone was on the phone or someone was coming to my door, I would write down what time it was and I'd circle it so those two times were together. And then at the next opportunity, I'd be like, oh. And so I'd already have like the descriptions written out, and then I could just kind of like add in the time. And so it was like watching like a point score go up. And so at any point in the day, I could be like, ooh, I've captured that much time. I'm like, I think I'm gonna leave at 5:30 today. That has not worked for anybody else I've worked with. And I'm married to a lawyer. And we are still working on figuring out what works for him. So gamification in general can be really great, but you kind of have to outsmart your brain a little bit, which is not very easy to do with a lawyer brain. So instead we dig down into like what your sounds funny, but like what's important to you, what's your value system? And because some people like money just isn't that important. So it's not like entering time is going to, it's like, it's obviously I get it. If I don't enter my time, I don't get paid. I get that. It's important, but that's not enough. So great question. It's the greatest work that we ADHD coaches do because it is so complicated. So everyone out there who struggles with it, you are not alone, neurotypical ADHD, everyone. It's hard.
Alrighty, I have another question here. A little bit of context. There's a profound difference in diagnosis for ADHD between the EU and the US, especially amongst kids. Hence, the differences reported around 1 to 2% of kids in the EU and 12% of kids in the US. That's what he believes or remembers. And a lot of this stems from the differences in cultural values and norms and expectations, essentially, in take the Dutch, kids can be fidgety and they don't focus, but they also have a very different perspective on education and, the pedagogy. His question, what are your thoughts either way on this difference in diagnoses stemming solely from cultural differences?
I don't think solely would be it, but there's a lot there. I think about just the way that the American education is set up. It was set up to train kids to work on assembly lines. Can you think of more boring work? Boredom to the ADHD brain is akin to death. Like it's a physical sensation of like it's so uncomfortable. So being in a situation that feels boring for an ADHD kid, like in a classroom, that's going to lead to fidgeting. That's them trying to regulate in some way. So in America, yes, we do not value and respect children in an age-appropriate way. And in fact, that's something that, with my daughter, I would have loved to have gotten her a diagnosis sooner, but it wasn't, it was, we didn't, we couldn't, because it's like, well, some of what that is actually age appropriate. Like little kids have emotional dysregulation. And then when it got to be no longer sort of like, and from a developmental perspective, like psychology, developmental psych stuff, that's when it was like, okay, now can we, like, let's start looking at that. And especially here, there are different expectations for girls and boys, especially in the classroom. And that's why there's so much more overdiagnosis of boys than girls. And they used to think that girls suffered disproportionately more from inattentive ADHD, which it used to be called like ADD. Now it's just either you're inattentive, hyperactive, or combined. But I was an ideal student. I didn't fidget. I didn't space out. That wasn't it. My hyperactivity is in my brain. I have, like, when I'm not on medication, I have at least 3 to 5 songs running through my head. I thought that was normal. Multiple thoughts happening at the same and just bouncing, constant ideas and stuff. And when I take medication on a good day, I get that down to like maybe 2 things at once. So my hyperactivity was socially acceptable because it was invisible. Whereas if you've got a kid who's like fidgety or, I mean, I'm very, obviously very talkative. And that was probably the only thing I ever got in trouble for. But there is definitely a cultural component to it. And I think there's also like the educational part of it, in that outside the United States, there is more of an emphasis on doing stuff outside the classroom and less emphasis on sitting at a desk all day. And like we have sent our kids to what I call a hippie school, where most of their activities are done outside, just in an experiential way, for part of their education, I should say. So I think that there's a lot going on there, and I absolutely have a bias as somebody who was overlooked with ADHD because I suffered tremendously for 40 years, and I would have loved to have had these tools and this knowledge sooner. So for me, it's less about like exactly how we diagnose this stuff. It's about, and that's one thing that I was one positive I was trying to pull out of that New York Times magazine article yesterday, where it's like, because if you have ADHD and it's not, the symptoms aren't severe and affecting your life negatively because you are in a line of work where it's fine, great. Like, that's wonderful. So it's more about like, does your ADHD present problems for you? Is your ADHD debilitating for you? Or have you found ways to manage it that work for you, whether that's with medication or otherwise? Of course, you have to have a diagnosis for that. But I think it in the way that it's like autism spectrum disorder, it ADHD symptoms are on a spectrum as well. And there's like over 200 symptoms, so it's like we don't all have the same symptoms manifesting. So it's a good question, and it's a hard thing to kind of isolate, I think, as an answer.
Alrighty, it looks like we just have one last question here from Peter asking, how can you develop helpful tips for dealing with organization issues, such as having problems with proofreading documents?
Yeah, proofreading that, yes. So it depends on everything depends, right? Depends on like what type of document, what things you've tried. As a career coach, I'd go through this stuff with people in with like cover letters and resumes. And so it might vary if we're talking about something that you yourself have created versus something that someone else has brought to you. Now, my neurotypical husband, he's also a transactional lawyer. He will literally take a ruler and just go line by line. I'm like, that's not gonna happen. So what for me, reading something aloud, I know I could never read a commercial lease out loud. That wasn't helpful for me. But reading out loud can be really helpful if you're proofreading for errors. Also reviewing a document from bottom to top. So not reading backwards, but like reading the last sentence first, then the sentence above it. So these are things for sort of like grammatical typo. Also be looking, if you're looking, it's proofreading, which, try to read for like one error at a time. So it's like, I am going to read aloud to check for grammatical errors. Then I'm going to read bottom to top to look for punctuation errors or whatever the case may be. So it's like, are you looking at citations? Are you proofreading citations for a brief? Are you, reviewing it for content? If it's a matter of you don't want to do it because it's boring, there are, we're not, our interest-based systems aren't great with rewards unless they are very frequent and near in time. Getting it into like that window of now. So for me, when I'm having, a tough day or whatever, and I just need to write an email or do something that doesn't seem that big of a deal, I have these sour gummy bears that I have because sourness can kind of kickstart your brain a little bit sometimes. And so I'll be like, if I write one sentence, I get a gummy bear. And so it's like very, it doesn't work every day. It only works on those really hard days. So if you're like, I need to proofread this for this type of reason, or I need to proofread for that type of reason, you can say, I'm gonna, it's kind of, this is kind of one way of gamifying. I read one sentence, I revise it as needed, blah, blah, blah. Then I get an M&M, then I get a gummy bear, then I get to go do some jumping jacks, whatever the reward is for you that's like really quick and a quick win type of deal. There's one other thing. Oh, an easy way to gamify things as well. I have timers all over it. My time distortion is very severe. So this is like a clock, but when I turn it on, so I don't have to go into a phone and get lost with what I'm doing. I have them in so many different denominations. So I could say, I'm just going to proofread for three minutes. 3 minutes, I put it down, it keeps track for me, and I might say, I'm going to try to get this far in 3 minutes. So you're kind of racing the clock, and that's a way of gamifying something sort of boring. So my sense is that it's like a detail thing that might be boring, tedious. And so those are, some gamification there, some urgency with the timer. But, it's going to be hard to. Oh, novelty. One other thing is if you're struggling with proofreading, it's just super boring. You can just move your location. Maybe if you're using like a colored, pen or like a highlighter or something. Like I practice what I preach. I have like multiple colors of things to make it more interesting or novel. You can listen to your favorite music. You can have a TV show on in the background if that helps you. So, those are
Thank
just some
you so
ways to
much.
leverage your interest-based triggers.
Sorry to interrupt. Can you tell us more about that clock? Somebody just asked, what's that clock called? It looks great.
Oh, it is a, okay, it's the brand is all lowercase, MOOAS. And it's Korean made. And I got these as gifts over the years. I'm like, I want more denominations. So I have four, and I have a lot of them here right now, but I would keep one like in the bathroom because I would lose track of how long it takes me to get ready because it's boring and many, many steps. But it's great because it's a clock. And so like because what I find can be tricky is if I need to pick up a child from school or a practice or something, but I want to get something done, if I don't have a timer there to track time for me, I'm too focused on the time to like do the task. So this allows me to like get that out of my mind. And also with setting a timer in a phone, that's just a recipe. I open my phone and I'm like, why am I here? The equivalent of walking into a room and being like, why am I here? What am I looking for? So this is my workaround for that deal. But they fit in like purses, briefcases. I love them. They're a little pricey. I mean, they're probably like $20 sometimes, but I like them.
Thank you so much, Annie. That was a great tip on the clock and so many others. We learned so much today and just really appreciate your time and expertise and are looking forward to your next program.
Yay, me too. This was so wonderful. Thanks for having me. I hope everyone got something out of today.